Now, most of us know about the importance of eating and drinking and living healthy generally, but especially during pregnancy. But there are some worrying new figures in relation to alcohol consumption when it comes to pregnancy as well. Let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us. Don't forget to like and subscribe. And go back and listen to the rest of this dadhood series that we've been running about new parenting and about parenting in general, about pregnancy. Lots of different advice there if you're expecting, if you've just had a new kid, or whatever your situation would be, or maybe you're just interested. But as we were doing this over the last little while, we got some new figures in and new data in relation to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and FASD rather, Ireland had this particular information out, and I'm joined now by the Chief Executive Officer Tristan Casson-Rennie. Tristan, thanks a million and welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
You might just start, I suppose, with explaining fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. What is it?
Well, it's a neurodevelopmental disability that is caused by prenatal alcohol exposure, and that can be by either parent. So, essentially, if a man consumes one drink in the 64 days before conception, or if the woman consumes one drink, I should say, of alcohol in the time immediately before conception or in the 9 months of pregnancy, then it raises the risk of FASD in their developing baby. It is lifelong and it causes irreversible brain damage. And currently, today in Ireland, the HSE reports that one in 10 babies is born with a form of FASD.
Wow. So there's a few stats there that are just remarkable to jump into. The 1 in 10, first of all, I mean, that's way higher than I would have thought. Is that all forms of it? I mean, from the spectrum of something that's very, very mild up to quite severe?
Yes, essentially, because it's a spectrum, it does cover four different conditions, which, I would say 10% of the cohort of children born with FASD in Ireland actually live with FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome. And that's one that people are more likely to know of, because it comes with what we call dysmorphic facial features. So we can actually identify these children when they are born, by the way in which the face is constructed slightly differently because of the interference of the alcohol. But the other 90% of those children, essentially, we wouldn't start to see symptoms appearing until they were around the age of 5, but they'd be fully apparent by the age of 10.
We might get into some of those in a second, but the other stat you mentioned that really caught my ear there is for the men, one drink in 64 days before. I mean, that's what, 2 months prior to conception. Okay, if you're planning, if you're planning a baby, maybe you're abstaining and you're trying to do all that sort of stuff. But I mean, there'll be an awful lot of people who, baby was conceived after a night out, or who just might have had a glass of wine with dinner. That like. When you say one alcoholic drink, what's the percentage risk? Or can you even quantify it in that sense? I mean, I presume having 100, it makes it much more likely than having the one preconception.
In men, not so. So, essentially, when a man consumes alcohol, it causes what we call epigenetic changes to the sperm cellular structure. And so we have to look at the life cycle of the sperm cell, which we know to be 64 days. And so that's why it's so significant that the clock starts ticking from the day of the last drink. So science over the last year, year and a half, has told us that essentially, if a man has a drink, it can do one of three things. It can carry the signature of the alcohol into the egg, which predisposes the egg to be more vulnerable to the impact of alcohol should the mother have a drink of alcohol. It can also cause the child to be born with symptoms similar to FASD, but not FASD. So that would be perhaps similar symptoms to ADHD or autism that we would see in the child. And then finally, what we also know is that it predisposes the offspring to possibly, but most likely, encounter challenges around cardiovascular, renal, inflammatory, and diabetic challenges when they reach the age of 40. So we're actually setting off a ticking time bomb if the father has one single drink in that 64 days. And I suppose, realistically, because we didn't know any of this data until the last sort of couple of years, that goes a long way to explain why we have so many people in Ireland over the age of 40 who are encountering lots of these problems.
Wow, that's remarkable to think you're storing a problem up for 40 years at that early age. Does it matter the type of drink if you have a pint that's 5% versus a whiskey that's 40%?
No, essentially alcohol is classed as a teratogen, and a teratogen is essentially a toxin that is capable of crossing the placenta. And so when it's ingested, for example, or it comes into contact with the developing fetus, it causes abnormalities to happen. It causes changes in the cellular structure. Another teratogen that you might be more familiar with is thalidomide, and we outlawed that here in Ireland in 1962. Needless to say, if alcohol was invented today, it wouldn't ever get through the stringent tests. It wouldn't be legally available to people because we now have the science that proves the harm that it can cause.
Have you seen, I suppose, an increase in the last few years of these cases after COVID, when people maybe would have been doing more drinking at home, people leaned on it as a crutch. Has it increased, or were we just taking what people were doing in the pub anyway, and bringing it home?
We certainly know that the numbers of babies being born in Ireland with FASD have increased. There was a survey carried out by the Journal of American Medical Pediatrics that disclosed 4.75% of our population were living with FASD at the time. That's 2017. The HSE, though, revised that number in 2022 to up to 7.4% of population. And again, that number further now in their disclosure is that they estimate 1 in 10 children, 1 in 10 babies is born with a form of FASD. So we know that number has gone up with COVID placed neatly in the middle of that. And again, in COVID, the numbers of babies being born in Ireland increased for the first time in 12 years. And of course, drinking at home was huge. There was very little else to do in terms of going out to meet people. Pubs were closed, as in dry pubs were closed, or sorry, wet pubs were closed. And so the volumes of alcohol being sold for off sales increased exponentially. And so people were drinking at home. They weren't really subject to measures of drinks. They weren't subject to time being called at the bar. They could just drink and drink. And so what happened was we had this pattern over 2 years of more babies being born and more alcohol being drunk at home. Now, if you remember what I said about the 90% of babies will be born and we won't see the symptoms of FASD until they reach the age of 5, we're now kind of in the fifth and sixth year of those babies being born. And so we're starting to see those children now in volume as they're attending school, and it's easier to identify those symptoms once you take the child out of the home environment and put them with a mixture of, say, 25, 30 children. It's easier to see which children are missing milestones or aren't quite achieving the same amounts as what their peer group is.
I suppose a lot of people, and I would include ourselves in this, that we've just had a child in the last 6 weeks, our first child, and my wife didn't go near anything for a long time, and you would think most people know you don't drink when you're pregnant, not in a way that we maybe previous generations didn't. You don't smoke when you're pregnant if you can not do that. So, is it a case that maybe those people who are drinking while they're pregnant, is that down to, do you think, a lack of information, which seems a little bit implausible, I suppose, to most people? Is it maybe an addiction thing, or what are the cases that you are seeing where women maybe are drinking during pregnancy that is then leading to this down the line.
Well, I'm good with stats, which is obviously a good to be able to answer your question. So, again, 2017, a survey carried out here in Ireland by Professor Sharif discovered that 81% of women had disclosed that they had consumed at least one drink of alcohol during pregnancy. That's a very incredibly high number. On the flip side of that, a later survey, 77% of men had disclosed that they were drunk at the point of conception. So it is a shared responsibility. So we have to consider that here in Ireland, drinking alcohol has been socially acceptable for a significant number of years. If you go back to the late 1980s, even hospitals were still serving Guinness on maternity wards to, and I put in quote here, to help the mother with iron and to stop the baby being born with anemia. We now know that just wasn't fact. You would have to drink over 100 pints of stout, so any form of stout, to even replicate 5 milligram of vitamin D, for example. So, you have to put that into perspective. So it is a case that we don't have that public health knowledge here in Ireland today. There is very little information in the public domain. 2 in 5 pregnancies are unplanned today in Ireland. And so they are critically the ones which are most at risk, because if somebody finds out they're pregnant and it is unplanned and alcohol features in their just social environment, then the chances are that the fetus has been exposed. Even if they're having one drink of wine on a Friday night, the chances are that fetus has been exposed to alcohol perhaps 6 times over 6 weeks. And
And how
that's
much do,
highly damaging.
yeah, of that 81%, again, remarkable statistic. Do you know how much of that was before they knew they were pregnant? As in, they might, it might, be a number of weeks before they knew they were pregnant, and they might have just carried on normal life.
Yeah, we don't have that data. We just have the snapshot in time that it was 81% at some point through pregnancy.
Wow,
But
that's.
we are the second highest prevalence in the world. We only sit behind South Africa at 11.1%, but we are the highest in Europe, if we take the 7.4% to be an accurate estimate from the HSE.
So when it comes then to identifying symptoms, and you mentioned those that are immediately obvious in terms of facial features, the ones that aren't and that only really appear when they're going to school or maybe late stage creche, what are you looking out for?
Well, there's lots of things that we're looking out for. Generally, and again, I will generalize here. I'll give you some of the data that we have for Ireland, which is that children and young people living with FASD, around 70% of those will live with a comorbid condition of ADHD. So if there's a diagnosis of ADHD, then it's a fairly high chance that FASD may be there as well, but it's perhaps never been discussed at primary care or pediatric level as to, what was the pregnancy like? Was it planned? Did alcohol feature? So we have a diagnosis there of ADHD, but we don't have actually the underlying cause, which in this case might be FASD. That's not to say everybody with a diagnosis of ADHD is going to be connected to FASD, but what it tells us is that if a person has a diagnosis of FASD, then 70 or 7 in 10 of those will have a comorbid condition of ADHD. But there are 428 different comorbid conditions associated with FASD. So one of the other ones that is really strikes me is that around 2 in 3 or 66% of people living with FASD will also have chronic otitis media, which are complications with the middle ear. So this might be what we used to call glue ear. It might be recurrent ear infections. They may have had grommets as a young child that helps them to drain their eustachian tubes. The grommets fall out, and then the eardrums just don't reheal, and so they may have to go through surgery to get the eardrums to reheal, and then it breaks down again. And that kind of pattern, that's consistent with 2 in 3 of the people that are diagnosed with FASD. Other comorbid conditions might be sensory processing disorders. They may have real challenges around their short-term memory. It may not function. They will certainly not be able to sleep for very many hours through the night. The average sleep attainment is between 3 to 4 hours, and that's because their bodies are flooded with cortisol, and so they're not making sufficient melatonin to be able to control their body clock. So they will literally fall asleep when they're exhausted. And that's difficult for a young child because they're growing, so they need to sleep to grow. And of course, if they're not sleeping, we then see them in the lower percentile when they're being measured, perhaps for their body size and growth and so on and so forth. So there are lots of different flags to look out for. Our website will contain most of those rather than going through all 428 here. But certainly there are lots of young people today in Ireland who are going about their day living with a diagnosis of something, but actually what they're really living with is a diagnosis of FASD, but they haven't got that recorded.
How do you go about diagnosing FASD as, you know, let's just say a child had ADHD. How do you then go about to satisfy yourself that yes, FASD is also present and it's not just a case of ADHD?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question here in Ireland, and which is why I set up FASD Ireland in 2021. Currently, Ireland is one of the few countries in the developed world that does not recognise FASD as a neurodevelopmental disability. We don't have any recognition across state agencies for the condition. And as a result of that, the HSE does not have a national clinical lead for FASD. They have had, up until February of this year, a national lead for FASD prevention, but that post has just been retired. So we wait with bated breath to see what happens there. But in terms of services like the NCSE, the National Council for Special Education, it's took a long time and a lot of patience from our organisation working with them to get them to acknowledge that FASD is prevalent in our classrooms and that the children living with the condition need support. So in terms of getting a diagnosis, it's been very thin on the ground until recent days, even I can say, most people in Ireland would have had to have left Ireland to get a diagnosis. They would have had to have gone to the UK National Clinic in Surrey, in southern England, and that would have been a private referral and probably a 2.5 year waiting list. And I know of families that have gone to the Barcelona Clinic in Spain, and I know of families that go to Canada for a diagnosis there. And that's simply because, again, our primary care, pediatrics, CDNTs, CAM services just simply don't have the expertise or the knowledge to be able to assess and diagnose FASD because we don't have a national clinical lead. Now, I said that's all changed in recent days. It has for a tiny, tiny cohort of people. I'm really pleased to say that there's been a bit of work going on with a clinic in County Dublin. Treehouse Clinic, and they are now providing under the stewardship of Professor Farhana Sharif from the HSE a diagnostic clinic for care experienced children. So any children who are under the care of TUSLA or ha who have been under the care of TUSLA can now request a referral through their TUSLA social worker for an assessment for FASD. That's a massive leap forward for Ireland. It's the first time we've seen that happen. But we have a long way to go. If you imagine, there are currently around 64,000 children of school age living with FASD that are currently undiagnosed, and it's going to take a number of years to even think about putting even a clinic in place and then an assessment and diagnosis process in place.
Finally, then, Tristan, if someone does get through all of that in the future or has had it done in another country, is there anything you can do about it? Is there any treatment or mitigation?
Yeah, there's no treatment as such. We can't go into the brain and rewire it, unfortunately. And a lot of people will wonder why the brain is so impacted. Well, essentially, when a fetus is developing, the fetus doesn't have the organs to process the toxins like the li liver and kidneys, and the brain is the only developed organ big enough to process the alcohol. So that's why the brain is impacted so much in FASD. So we don't have the ability to go in and do that surgery or even understand what that might look like yet. But what we can do is we can provide a supportive work around the child or the young adult or even the adult. I mean, the oldest person that we currently work with is 77, and we provide supports to him living with his FASD. So we work with what's called the team around the child. We ask them to look at their environments, the way in which they perhaps parent or care for somebody. We work with employers, we work with clinicians, we work with schools, and that's about putting that framework in place so that we can better support that person. And we have an understanding of why they behave and act and process things in the way that they do. And of course, importantly, with FASD, we afford them the time to be able to process because everything is delayed.
Well, look, Tristan, thanks a million for joining us on the podcast and for raising a bit of awareness about it. I'd say it's something a lot of people will be quite shocked to hear some of the figures that you've put out there and the potential prevalence of it. Thanks a million for joining us, and hopefully speak to you again in the future.
Sure. You're welcome. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Let Me Explain. We'll be back next week, probably, with your next episode. I'll chat to you soon.